This episode of the Braving Business Podcast is sponsored by, well, me. I'm PJ Benoit, and I've been in the domestic and international logistics space for over 30 years. If you need any assistance with transportation or logistics, my team and I will jump at the chance to help. Whether it be parcel shipments, e-commerce, pallets and freight, full truckload, international air and ocean, imports, exports, warehousing and distribution, or really anything under the logistics umbrella, we got you covered. For more details, please go to shipwithpj.com. That's shipwithpj.com. Reach out to me there. Mention you found me on this podcast for a special surprise. And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business Podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
PJ Benoit, how are you, brother?
I am doing fan-freaking-tastic. How are you, my fine feathered friend?
I cannot complain. I am just a couple more days of work, and then I'm taking my kids and my grandkids on a week cruise. I cannot wait.
Oh, my gosh. Nice. Are you going anywhere fun?
Indeed. You know, I'm not even sure. I mean, we're going someplace nice, I'm sure. I know Puerto Rico's on there because we really want to support the island. And the Dominican Republic. And then there's another place which I cannot stick in my mind. So there's one more place we're going to.
Somewhere in the
country. Mar-a-Lago.
I hope not. That is definitely not on the list.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So we have Guy Kawasaki on, and we're going to get into the very elaborate introduction as we always get into. But all right, I have to come clean because this is a podcast about vulnerability, and it's a podcast about all of these things. So, and I'm super embarrassed because Guy is also from the islands of Hawaii, and as all my family is, so you know I have a deep embarrassment for the Ohana. Guy was on a podcast of a personal friend of mine, Andrew Mitrack, who does the history of marketing. And so he was on the podcast of my friend Andrew. So I was like, oh my God, Andrew, you had Guy Kawasaki on. That's amazing. Except when I read the name, I thought it was Guy Kiyosaki who wrote Rich Man, Poor Man.
No, you got that wrong too, PJ.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not the guy who wrote Rich Man, Poor Man.
You got that rich wrong. Dad, poor dad.
Or rich dad, poor dad. See, I got PJ. Everything. You know what? I should just quit. Anyway, so
just put down
faux pas after faux pas. Right, rich dad, poor dad. Thank PJ, you. Thank you, guys.
PJ, you're giving Howley's a bad name.
I give Howley's a bad name every day, Guy. and I'm turning red, which matches the orange. So I reached out to Guy, and I'm like, Guy, please come on our show. You're fantastic. I read your book. I think you're great. And he's like, yeah, wrong guy. And I was like, oh my.
And then, yet here he is.
And then, so. and he was so kind, and I was so embarrassed. And my wife is half Japanese, Kara. And she was like, what are you doing? And I was like, Oh, I don't know. And so I like fell on my sword and I begged for forgiveness. And Guy was so kind, and he was like, yes, I'll be on your show. So I was like, thank you very much. So we have to be really nice to him today. And and so Guy, thank you so much for being on the show because you are just an amazing, amazing character.
Well, I
just wanted to see if you're going to ask me more about wealth and income secrets.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you could talk about it. I mean, you know a lot.
I don't believe in crypto and I don't believe in Donald Trump. But besides that, I'm just like Robert Kiyosaki.
There you go.
All right.
PJ, let's introduce this incredible guest, one of the best we've ever had. We say it all the time, and we have had incredible guests. But I think, yet again, we have exceeded our wildest expectations when we started this podcast. When you get a guy like Guy Kawasaki, not Kiyosaki, to come on your podcast, you have hit the big time. So PJ, introduce this man.
And despite my best efforts to make it impossible. Despite. So, ladies and gentlemen, brace yourselves for a journey of resilience and reinvention as we bring a true titan of marketing and innovation to the Braving Business Podcast. When Guy Kawasaki joined Apple in 1984, he didn't just help market the little known Macintosh, he transformed the very language of tech marketing, introducing the concept of evangelism.
That's a little overstated.
Oh, okay. Come on. Soak it up. He introducing the concept of evangelism that would redefine how brands connect with their audience. Now, as chief evangelist at Canva, Guy continues to pioneer with a vision that empowers creativity for all. In today's episode of Bringing Business, we're going to gain insights into Guy's remarkable journey, one that's been marked by pivotal moments and bold decisions, from navigating the turbulent waters of Silicon Valley to reinventing his career multiple times. His story is a masterclass in resilience and adaptation. Expect actionable takeaways on how to pivot under pressure and harness setbacks as stepping stones to innovation. Guy's track record speaks volumes, from propelling Apple's early successes to authoring 15 influential books, including The Art of the Start. His stint
on the didn't say The Art of the Deal. I was holding my breath. Go on.
You know, I don't need this abuse. All right. I can get that at home, which I am at home. His stint on the board of the Wikimedia Foundation further underscores his commitment to democratizing knowledge and creativity. So please join us as we delve into the mind of a true maverick who has not only survived the storm, but has thrived in it, offering invaluable lessons for entrepreneurs, executives, and anyone daring to leave a mark. Let's get ready to explore the art of turning challenges into triumphs with the fine Mr. Guy Kawasaki. Guy, welcome to Braving Business.
I just want to know, did ChatGPT write that intro?
No.
No, not at all.
No, we have a team of very aspiring and young minds, really.
Yeah, very young.
Okay.
Well, you know what? I'm going to let our audience in on a secret, Guy. We generally have a questionnaire, and that questionnaire informs tremendously what we end up writing in the introduction. And we didn't get one from you. Now, you're a big time, and we didn't require you to do one. And so I wouldn't be surprised if our fine staff did actually get some advice from AI.
But
let's just put that where it is. Guy, you've had quite a journey, and you have actually, you know, at least according to Wikipedia, came up with the concept of evangelical marketing. And I'd love to have you take us to the moment where you realized the power of platform evangelism. And how did that become a thing for you? You're working on the Macintosh. Okay. Suddenly that idea just occurs to you. I mean, help us
no,
into your
no,
mind
no,
a little
no,
bit.
No, 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 no. So first of all, this is faux pas podcast. It's evangelistic, not evangelical. I'm not an evangelical. I believe in women's rights. I believe in LGBT2+ rights. I believe in voting rights. I believe in vaccination. I'm not an evangelical. Let's just get that straight. And
well, you know what? The term evangelical is about someone that believes in things. I don't think that the term itself is what defined. But anyway, carry on.
We also believe in all those
all
things,
your
so.
Republican sponsors. No more NRA dollars coming into you. So.
I don't think we have any of those. So we're totally in your we're on your side, guys. So please continue.
Well, we are on the side of truth and anyway. Let's get off that soapbox.
So yeah. Evangelism comes from a Greek word meaning bringing the good news. So the first good news was eternal life with Jesus Christ, right? So then after that, there was a 2,000-year gap. So we went from Jesus to a guy named Mike Boych. Mike Boych was the first Apple software evangelist. I was the second. So I guess you could say I'm the second coming of software evangelism. But anyway, so what software evangelism meant is that we came to view Macintosh as good news, that it would make people more creative and productive. So it wasn't merely another hardware platform. It wasn't another personal computer. It was good news of increasing people's creativity and productivity. So as software evangelists, our job was to convince software companies and hardware companies to make products that supported this vision that a computer could be something that would make you more productive and creative.
I love that. I love that. But you know what's interesting about that is it is rooted ultimately in the concept of good news, right? And so you ultimately, you drew some inspiration from religion there, and there's nothing wrong with that, right?
Yeah, I mean, after all, Christianity has a 30% market share. I mean, that's bigger than Apple's market share.
Certainly bigger than my faith, but carry on. there's now a thing for the, you know, I'm as is well known by our audience, I'm Jewish, and we represent 0.06% of the human race. 0.06%. Anyway, so we are certainly not winning any competition for membership. DJ.
But you know what? Can I tell you something funny? So when I was in college, excuse me, when I was getting my master's of business administration, I was in a 4-day-a-week program. And because I came from a poor family, I had to work on the off days. So I took a job working for a Jewish jewelry manufacturing company in downtown LA. And this company made jewelry that sold it to retailers. And so I am pretty well steeped in Jewish traditions and, you know, Jewish things. And, you know, I can, you know, listen, I can say Mazel Tov, I can say L'chaim, I can say, you know, I can hold my own with most Jewish, for a goy as opposed to a guy, I can handle a lot of Jewish things. So, yeah, and I have great respect for the Jewish people, and working for that jewelry manufacturing company was a pivotal moment in my life because it taught me how to sell. So, you know, when I graduated from my MBA program, all my friends were like going to work for Accenture and, you know, McKinsey and Bain and Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and all that. And I was schlepping gold and diamonds.
Yeah, but look where it got you. I mean, that's really kind of remarkable. So that experience then, like, what do you think that experience taught you? Like what did you take from that?
Yeah. So listen, I think that in life there are two fundamental processes, right? So either you're making it or you're selling it. That's the two essential processes of life. And I'm not an engineer, so I couldn't make it, so I had to sell it. And the selling skills that I learned in the jewelry business have stuck with me to this very moment. And I honestly believe that people don't appreciate how much selling they have to do, whether it's, you know, getting an upgrade on United Airlines or whether convincing TSA that, oh yeah, my real ID doesn't exactly match my boarding pass, but trust me, that's me. Let me go. You know, if you want reservations and the restaurant is full, I mean, you're always selling. And what I learned in the jewelry business is, well, rejection, because hand-to-hand combat in the jewelry business, you know, you make an appointment, you fly out to Kansas City to meet with a jeweler, you're supposed to meet him at 10 o'clock, you're there at 9:45. Around noon, they let you in, you know, so you've been waiting 2 hours with your bag and you finally show them your line of goods and they give you 15 minutes and they're offering you prices that's slightly above the scrap value of your gold and diamonds. And they need, you know, 180-day dating so that they want to buy it on day one, get delivered on day 30. And pay on day 210, you know, it's like all this kind of stuff. And if you don't want to do business, they don't care because there's another three people waiting in the lobby to show them their line of jewelry. So that's what you deal with in the jewelry business.
You know what? That's what you deal with in almost any business. Now, maybe not quite to that extreme, but what you just described is competition, which is intense. And the fact that oftentimes you may have done, coming into any situation, as much work preparing yourself as you could, both in terms of getting your product prepared, getting yourself prepared, being in the right place. And then on the other side is another party. And they're bringing in their priorities, their competitive position. That's where marketing, frankly, is genius, right? Because ultimately, in almost any situation, people have choices. Help me understand, you know, maybe let's go past the jewelry business and maybe talk more about the Macintosh and Canva. Help me understand, how do you think, at the end of the day, some individuals or companies stand out? What is it that drives so much business to go down one path versus another?
Well, one of the dangers of listening to someone on a podcast like this is you listen to their story and you think, oh, that must be the only way. So with the caveat that I'm telling you one way, not necessarily the only way. So I think the lesson of Apple is that there are enough people in the world who care about user interface, care about elegance, and care about design. Now, obviously, not everybody does, because if everybody did, Microsoft Windows would not exist. But that's a different story.
Ouch.
So now, I think that's what I learned from Steve Jobs, that enough people care about design. And design is one of the ways to set yourself apart from your competition.
So true. You really said something, though. I mean, and you said it so succinctly, which is either you're selling or you're creating or you're making, right? And it's, you really hit on something, because everyone is selling. And I have said that throughout my career. I have told corporations that I've worked for that when I ran sales organizations, everyone is a salesperson. Doesn't matter who is talking to a customer. It doesn't matter. That phone rings, that's money. Whoever answers the phone is a salesperson, because that image that you portray, that experience that you are relaying to that customer, it's all about sales. And so it's so interesting, because I think nowadays a lot of people try to build something that just sells itself. And so
I mean that's a worthy goal, right?
Well, of course it is, but I think there's a disconnect, because, like, right now I'm talking to a company that there's a young gentleman. He's creating a mushroom coffee out in the UK, and he's very passionate about it. And he's you know, very bootstrapped and all that, and that's great. And I'm kind of like helping him out, because I'm old and I'm on his board of advisors or whatever. And that's great. But he's really trying to build the perfect product, and he's really in the weeds. And I'm like, hey, you got to go out and you got to take more of an evangelist approach. You have to be the guy. You have to go out, go to the market. You have to go to the coffee shops. You have to pump it up, talk to people, hand out samples, really connect with the people, see what they want to do, do your market research, all that kind of stuff. And he's reluctant to do that. He's like, well, the coffee should sell itself. I'm like, well, it will, but you got to show your passion. You got to connect those dots. You know what I mean? And so what would you say?
Honestly, I cannot think of a product in the history of man that sells itself. Well, maybe illicit drugs, but other than that, I mean, like what product sells itself? And that's a lesson everybody should learn, that, you know, basically nothing sells itself.
So, you know, and I agree with that. Actually, I think that generally speaking, there's always, even if you may be in a situation where you feel that you've not been sold, that's just very good marketing. It's not an indication that you weren't sold. Let's talk about that, right? So you've witnessed an evolution in marketing, right? I think back to Mad Men. I don't know if you've seen the show, and what marketing used to be, and, you know, the smoky rooms. And I look back at advertising in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, frankly, even the 90s and the early 2000s, and I cringe. So much has evolved. What would you say has stayed the same? What's changed dramatically in marketing?
Well, I think that the success to marketing, whether, you know, back in Mad Men days or today, it's still empathy. That is, you understand the needs of your customers and you work back from what they need as opposed to what you may like to do. So I'll give you a negative example. So, you know, in 1975, Kodak invented digital photography. So, first of all, you got to wrap your mind around that. Like, wait, Kodak invented digital photography. I'm not using a Kodak digital camera. Yeah.
So they protected their film business by not releasing it.
Yeah. And you know, so I think what Kodak did was they said, we're in the chemicals business. We put chemicals on paper, chemicals on film. We need to convince people to buy chemicals. And I think they did not realize that they are in the preservation of memories business. And right now we're preserving memories with chemicals. But imagine if people could preserve their memories and instantly see that they captured their memories. That's so much better than bringing back your film and getting it developed and hope you didn't have the lens cap on. And I think that is a key lesson of marketing. You work backwards from what people want, not forward from what you want.
Wow.
That's incredible insight.
So you've done, So you've had your hand in like shaping strategies from very small startups to major companies alike. What are some of the outcomes that you pay the most attention to when you're thinking about the successes of a new marketing strategy?
Well, I mean, let's just cut the bullshit and cut to the chase, right? And I have a 3-word saying that is, I think, the most important 3 words an entrepreneur can hear, which is sales fixes everything.
So true.
And as long as you got sales, you're in the game. And as long as you're in the game, you still have a chance. And so, you know, when I hear people use the S word, which is strategic, and when I hear them use the P word, which is partnerships, in my mind, that triggers to, oh, these losers do not have sales. So they got to talk about things that are strategic, and they got to talk about relations, which is not customer relations, but partner relationships. So just remember, sales fixes everything.
You know, I'm going to push back on that. I'm going to push back on that because, yes, that's true. Sales does fix everything, but everyone's got to start somewhere. And I think that a lot of the times you do start from a place of, well, you know what? I may not be Apple or a company with massive resources. I need to start from a place, and I would say a lot of our listeners are probably entrepreneurs who are small, mid-sized businesses. And to get to there from where they are, oftentimes it is about partnerships. Oftentimes it is about strategy, because you may not be shooting for the success of a Macintosh. You may simply be, you know, aiming to introduce a service to the marketplace and yourself as a credible provider in that space, and marketing's the path there. So bringing it back to maybe where many of our listeners might be, and I you know, what you said has its place, but I don't know that that's the only answer. And as you said before, there, the only answers you could provide are your own. But what's your insight into?
Wait, just time out for a second.
Sure.
I said strategic, not strategy. There's a difference, right? To me, strategic is a bullshit word. It's like, you know, we got to do this. I can't think of a really good reason why, so I'm going to call it strategic. A strategy is an explanation of how to accomplish something. So every company needs strategies. And in this case, I'm saying your number one strategy that you need is how to achieve sales. So don't confuse strategy with strategic. And then my problem with partnerships is that usually it's like, you know, two organizations, they're trying to say that, you know, we have this partnership because we have this weakness, and they have a partnership with us because they have this weakness. But I mean, if you're telling me that, you know, if you are a app company and you got Samsung to include your app in every Samsung phone, to me, that's sales. That's not a partnership.
Because Samsung is so much larger, right? Because you're riding on Samsung's coattails.
Yeah. So, but like I said before, I'm not saying I have the monopoly on knowledge, so could be wrong.
Well, I mean, look, your success speaks for itself. I mean, I think I have a different point of view. What can I say? I disagree with you. Actually, I think being strategic is appropriate, and it really depends on where you are. There's a saying, what you see depends on where you sit, right? And I think based on my experience and the experience of quite frankly many people that are in our audience, I think a lot of the times, you know, you don't have the luxury of looking past things like strategy or being strategic. You might view that as bullshit, and I respect your point of view. I see it differently.
That's okay.
No problem.
Well, how about this? Let's talk about Canva, right? You are the chief evangelist of Canva. And so obviously done well. And side note, my wife, Kara, she asked me to tell you thank you because she uses it every day. And she literally could not imagine life without it. So, and she's a romance author. So she does her own like kind of
covers.
Like she does like her social media stuff and all that, you know, like she works on her graphics and everything. And so it's a fantastic tool. Huh. And so
I was going to say, I thought you look very similar to Fabio.
I do that. Normally my shirt's off. So, Tell us about that journey. Tell, did you start it early or tell us like what stage were you at Canva? And obviously it's blown up now.
Okay. So I've been with Canva for about 10 years, and 10 years ago, it was, I don't know, 10 people in a little office, and they were trying to democratize design by making something that had design types, like, you know, a design type would be an infographic, a 16x9 presentation, Instagram post, a tweet, you know, all this kind of stuff. And within each design type, they had hundreds of designs already made as templates that you just needed to change the text or change the picture. So as opposed to Photoshop, where you start with a blank slate and you got to do everything, with Canva, we had the design laid out for you and you just customize it. And they found me because myself and my assistant were doing social media graphics for Twitter using Canva. And they saw that we were using Canva, so they reached out to me and asked me if they could meet with me. And to tell you the truth, when they reached out to me, I didn't know who they were. So I said to this Peg Fitzpatrick, who was working with me, I said, Peg, is Canva the thing you use for our graphics? And she said, yes. I said, and do you like it? And she said, yes. I said, do you think I should help them? And she said, yes. And that was the due diligence on Canva. And, you know, I think Canva is living proof that if you build a better mousetrap, you can catch a lot of mice, I guess is one way of saying it.
So let's talk about the transition though. So you obviously had a lot of success at Apple. For a lot of people, once you reach that type of pinnacle of success, it's hard to get motivated. How did you keep yourself motivated and not say, you know what, I've hung my shingle. Look at that. Look what I've accomplished.
Well, let me set the record straight. Okay. So, you know, I worked for Apple from 83 to 87 and 95 to 97. And that's way before Apple became the Apple that many people know, you know, multi-trillion-dollar company. So I was there when things were, you know, doing well for Apple, but I was also there when things were very bad for Apple. And I think I calculated once, if I added up all the money I made on options from Apple, it's about $250,000. I did not make a lot of money from Apple. And so if you're trying to say that, you know, Guy, you were so successful and, you know, you were sitting and, you know, life was already good and you didn't need to do anything, you didn't need to help Canva, that's not true. I was not by any means financially independent when I first started working with Apple. With Canva, don't get me wrong. I wasn't like, you know, having a part-time job at Starbucks, but I it's not the case where, you know, I came down from the mountain and I blessed Canva with my presence. It was a very mutually successful relationship for us.
Very cool. What was it like at Apple after, you know, because they had that success and then Steve Jobs like had the trouble and then they went down. And what was it like then? Like, what was it like being in a company like that had so much promise and then had trouble like that?
Well, to tell you the truth, I have this theory that just like sales fixes everything. The thing with Apple is that it was never as good or as bad as people thought. So when things are good at Apple, people thought it was really good and we're just printing money and everything is so easy. And when things were bad, they thought that the sales were zero and, you know, everything was just going to shit. And it was never at those two extremes.
But wasn't there like a lot of public, there was a lot of negative public perception though, right? Not negative, but like things were not all that great.
Well, I don't know. I'm not saying they were great, but it's not, we still had $2 billion in cash back then, right? So, and I don't, $2 billion doesn't sound like a lot today, but $2 billion back then in, you know, 1980s was a lot of money. And so it was never sort of, oh my God, you know, the end of the world is coming. And one of the things people should understand who are following business reporting, I think in reporting in general, is you only really hear about the bad news. Mm. You know, bad news, blood sells. And I mean, if you have fantastic success, that also sells. But generally speaking, you know, when you turn on the TV or you look at YouTube, you know, if you look at YouTube, it's all the bad stuff that's happening. Nobody says, oh, somebody had a good day, went home, loving family, they had a wonderful meal, then they played board games at night, they read each other's stories, and they went to sleep. You don't see that as a headline, right? But you see, like, somebody shot in a mall, or, you know, that's what makes news. So you have to kind of, you know, temper yourself about what you let influence your behavior, influence your attitudes.
Wow, wow.
So speaking of that, I mean, obviously you were proud of the role you played with the Macintosh. You wrote the book, The Macintosh Way. Is that the campaign you're most proud of being involved in? Or is there something, you know, a marketing campaign that you were there to watch birthed all the way through execution that you look back at now and say, that was as close to a masterpiece as I could have gotten?
Well, I mean, it would be easy to spin that tale because you could say, you know, Guy Kawasaki was at Apple from 83 to 87, and today it's $4 trillion, the most valuable company in the world. So yeah, what a meteoric smooth ride, and it's been wonderful and all that. But that's a little, you're kind of smoothing over a lot of cavities and holes and ups and downs. I think every company goes through, you know, some traumatic times. And the true test of a company is not that it never has trauma. The test is what you can do after the trauma. So I would say, for example, today, the true test of Tesla is not that it's so successful now. The true test of Tesla is going to be, can it recover from what has happened to its brand and its sales? That's going to show you what Tesla's made out of.
I got to say, Guy, that's the thing that you said that I that resonates the most for me, because I strongly believe that, generally speaking, it's challenges and trauma, but challenges. Trauma, if we're unfortunate, but challenges, even if we are, that are with us throughout the journey in business, right? You are right. If you look at anyone's bio, what people put on their LinkedIn profile, it's the highlights, and the highlights gloss over a whole lot of cavities.
Yeah.
This podcast is what it is because, generally speaking, when we interview people, we focus on the cavities. We focus on the challenge, on the how did you feel when, you know, we've had guests that talk to us about every piece of furniture in their house had been removed, and they had a pregnant spouse, or a husband had just had a stroke, and their business is failing, right? These moments, they don't make the highlight reel, but they are the moments that we learn the most from as individuals, yeah, as leaders, as companies. Is there a moment in your life, in your career, that you look at and say, you know what, that was a moment that could have broken me? And at the time, I was fracturing, but it actually made me.
Well, this is why maybe you should have had Robert Kiyosaki instead of Guy Kawasaki. But I have been very fortunate in my career. Now, I have not been so fortunate as to be a billionaire. And, you know, now I'm like a tech bro and I'm at the inauguration and all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, I have not had the true kind of trauma and overcoming, you know, this incredible negativity or this incredible tragedy. I honestly am just a lucky guy. But I realize I'm a lucky guy. I mean, it's not like I believe that I deserve this. I've been very fortunate. And, you know, like, I'll violate all HIPAA now. So I am deaf. Okay. So I use a cochlear implant. Look, you can see it right there. So I am deaf. And, you know, a lot of people say, Guy, you know, it must be so hard to be deaf. You know, it's like, how do you deal with that? And I have come to look at it like, well, A, I'd rather be deaf than blind. That's number one. I would rather be deaf than have pancreatic cancer. Ask Steve Jobs, would he rather be deaf or have pancreatic cancer? And I certainly would rather be deaf than dumb, because if you're deaf, you can get a hearing aid or a cochlear implant or learn sign language or lip reading. But if you're dumb, you're just dumb.
Oh my! Well,
that all right. True.
And as we started off this whole conversation, I'm in that latter stage. So
let's talk books. Guy's written a couple of books,
just like 15 of them.
I think so. Yeah.
So all right. So what about Wise Guy? Tell us about Wise Guy. Like what really kind of was the impetus of that book? Why what brought you to the keyboard?
Well, I can tell you something that no other author will tell you. When you ask an author, why did you write your book? We all give bullshit answers. Like, I wanted to make the world a better place. I wanted to communicate these methods to end climate change. I wanted to ensure people had fresh water. I wanted to ensure economic equality for people. But I'm telling you, if most authors answered you honestly and you said, Guy, why did you write your book? I would tell you, I got a really big advance. That's the honest answer. So that at one level is an answer. You know, I mean, it's clearly because sales, aka advances, fix everything, right? So I wrote Wise Guy because I wanted to compile the stories of my life that taught me lessons so that people could read these stories and gain knowledge without having to go through what I went through. So, I mean, do you want me to tell you a story that illustrates that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love that.
Okay, so... So, you know, a lot of people, they worry about their motivation in life, like, you know, curing cancer, making the world a better place, economic equality, all that. So let me tell you, I have a theory that it doesn't matter what motivates you as long as you are motivated. The key is to be motivated, and you don't need to worry about the crystal pure white, you know, high end, high road motivation. Just get motivated and just start doing stuff, right? So I'll tell you that when I was growing up in Kalihi Valley in Hawaii, which is a very poor part of Hawaii, somebody gave me a ride in a Porsche. And I got out of that car and I said, holy shit, this is why you got to work. You want to buy a Porsche. So, you know, people were saying about, I want to fix the world. I just wanted to fix the car. So, and then in high school, I was catching a bus from one, the bad side of town to the good side of town. And twice I got hijacked on the bus. And I said to myself, God, you have got to study hard and work hard. You have got to make it so that you don't have to live in a dangerous area and you don't have to catch the bus. So now as I look back and I say, you know, and people ask me, well, what motivated you, God? I tell them, because I got a ride in a Porsche and I got robbed twice. That's what motivated me. That's one of the stories in Wise Guy. And now, you know, like, am I supposed to be ashamed of that? Did it lead to suboptimal results? I mean, you know, I studied hard. I work hard. Here I am. It's because I got a ride in a Porsche and I got robbed. What's wrong with that?
No, nothing. And Kalihi is not, it is a rough area for sure. and Tal, I don't know if you know this, but the bus in Hawaii is called the bus. That is the actual name of the transit system. It's the bus.
Oh, I got you. I was going to say, as opposed to what?
Yeah, like in Chicago, it's the CTA. In Hawaii, it's the bus, which is awesome. What's another? So if you were out of the Wise Guy book, if there was a story that you wanted to kind of translate for a budding entrepreneur, right? So that was a good one, like motivation. Like if there's another one that you thought was important to impart on a budding mind that was about to start a business that you thought would be helpful as they were dipping their toes into the sea of entrepreneurialism, what would you, you know, they're at Sandy Beach and they're about to go in and they don't know that it's 50 pounds of per square inch of undertow and that a shore break. And, you know, they don't want to get dragged out, but, you know, they have no idea. What are you going to tell them? What's the story?
Well, first of all, I mean, I told you the Kodak story already, right? And I think the Kodak story is one of the most important stories anybody in business can hear, that, you know, Kodak could own the world with digital photography today. It would be in every phone, every camera, every everything. But no, they define their business incorrectly. So entrepreneurs have to step back and figure out what is it we're actually giving our customer. For whether it's chemicals or digital sensors or whatever, you know, that's the key. And so that is one of the most important stories. I told you about my motivation. Can I tell you another motivation story?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, you're gonna think I am such a plastic and insipid and, you know, simple person. But so one day, I finally got a Porsche. I was in my Porsche on El Camino in Menlo Park. I pull up to this stop sign. I look to my left. There's a car with four teenage girls, and they're making eye contact with me. They're laughing. They're smiling. I'm thinking, Guy, you have truly arrived. They know you because of your books, your speaking, your work at Apple, your hot startup in the .com business. So the girl in the front seat says, roll down your window. I roll down my window. She sticks her head out and she says to me, are you Guy? Excuse me. I just blew the punchline. She sticks out her head and she says to me, are you Jackie Chan?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
And that. You think, I guess it's better to be confused with Jackie Chan and Robert Kiyosaki, but that's a different story. What's the lesson here?
Humility, it's humility.
Ever since that day, one of my goals is that Jackie Chan is in his S-Class or is his Bentley and he's in, I don't know, he's in Hong Kong or wherever he lives, and car full of teenage girls, pulls up to him at the stoplight, asks him to put down his Bentley's window, and they stick out their head and they say, "Are you Guy Kawasaki?" That's my goal. And can I tell you one more great story that'll illustrate Wiser Guy, the book? So my wife and I and a baby boy were living in San Francisco on Union Street. Union Street dead ends into the Presidio. And let's just say it's not Kalihi Valley. PJ, it's more like Wailai Kahala. It is, okay, you know, arguably one of the best parts of San Francisco.
Absolutely.
So I'm outside my house and I'm trimming the bougainvillea bush. And this older white woman comes up to me and she says, "Do you do lawns too?" and I could only laugh. And I said, "Oh, I'm Japanese, so you think I'm the yard man, right?" She goes, No. It's just you're doing such a great job trimming your bougainvillea. I wonder if you do lawns too. So there's one lesson there, which is about racial stereotyping, right? So that's lesson number one. But there's a better lesson coming. 2 weeks later, my father comes from Hawaii. I'm Sansei. I'm third generation. So obviously, he's Nisei. He served in the U.S. Army, you know, the whole shtick, right? And I tell him this story, and I think my father is just going to freaking flip out. He is just going to lose his mind that his son, who went to Stanford and went to UCLA and worked for Apple and has written, you know, at that point, maybe 6 books, this Haole woman thinks that he's the yard man just because he's Japanese, right? And so I'm fully expecting to get just this like tidal wave tsunami of emotion. And my father says to me, "You know, son, where you live in San Francisco, a Japanese man cutting the bougainvillea bush statistically is the yard man. So get over it, son. She didn't mean anything by the benefit of the doubt. Don't let that get into your head. Maybe she just wanted a yard man. She wasn't calling you, you know, a yard man, Japanese, you know, immigrant, whatever." And that's the day I learned to take the high road and give people the benefit of the doubt and not look for trouble when there isn't any fair.
Nice.
Because so much trouble is going to come your way anyway. You do not need to look for it.
Oh, all right. Awesome. Can I ask one super, super fast question? And thank you. Thank you for sharing that. The amazing launch of Macintosh, which I still remember back to this day, the 1984 commercial. What was that like? Like, were you at the driver's seat for that? Were you like what was the genius behind all that?
Well, the genius was that there was a guy named Mike Murray who was director of marketing, and he kind of told, you know, Shia Day to make, you know, to leave it up to their creativity. And they showed that commercial to the board of directors of Apple. And the board of directors hated it, right? They just hated it. It wasn't like traditional speeds and feeds and this is why you should buy a Macintosh and, you know, blah, 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 blah. It showed a woman running down an auditorium and swinging this axe, and the axe goes and hits this image of totalitarian George Orwellian 1984 IBM, you know, thought control, kind of like what the U.S. is evolving into right now, but we were way ahead of our time. And so it was so metaphorical and so far, sort of far removed from schlepping computers that the board hated it. The board wanted to cancel it. And Mike Murray told them that, I think it was like, it's too late to cancel. We already paid for the ad. So we either got to eat it or not. And to this day, I'm not sure if that was true or not. But anyway, so we ran the ad, and it was a great ad. And, you know, it's known as one of the greatest ads in the history of advertising.
Yeah,
that's Guy, the story.
When you saw that ad the first time, did you know that? Did something tell you this was going to be great, or did you not know? And this is yet another example that even amazing things a lot of times start without people knowing that they're going to be amazing.
Well,
things. Just luck. And,
you know, listen,
good fortune, good timing, et cetera.
If you worked in the Macintosh division, you were really in the reality distortion field. I mean, you were living, breathing reality distortion. And when you saw IBM positioned as the evil George Orwellian totalitarian thought police, information control, it was like a strike for liberty. It was a strike for freedom. It was a strike for, you know, all these great things we all believed in. So I think one of the most emotional moments of my life when I saw that commercial. And then when I saw Steve Jobs introduce the Macintosh.
Mm. Oh, that's awesome. Amazing.
I hope everybody once in their life has an opportunity to experience something like that.
Your words to God's ears, sir.
Well, amen.
I'll ask one quick Steve Jobs question because he was notorious for being difficult.
Difficult.
Yeah, I'm just being respectful. He was a bit of an ass, but I don't know that firsthand. So I'm saying it based on what I've read, what I've heard. What was it like to work for Steve Jobs, and what lessons in leadership did you take good and
Sure. So I tell you, it is an honor and a privilege to have worked for him. I consider that his influence in my life really enabled me to succeed for much of my life. Now, I don't want to paint a picture that I was in his inner circle and his BFF. I was, you know, one or two circles out of it, but just the force of his personality was so strong. And he taught so many lessons about elegance and design and perfectionism and high expectations and motivation and evangelism, how to get people to believe in what you believe in. Now, on the other hand, I have to tell you that he managed by fear. So the way it worked was, you know, he would not hesitate to rip you to shreds in front of the whole division, right? And I saw him do that a few times, and I said to myself, shit, guy, you are not going to be the guy that he rips like that. So contrary to every HR theory that you have ever heard about, you know, positive psychology, focusing on the good points, communicating clearly, being open and transparent, having mutually agreed goals, all that stuff. He just ruled by fear, and it was very effective. So now, you know, yes, he was, shall I say, an orifice to people. But I tell you what, I've been in Silicon Valley for 40, 50 years, so I know all about orifices, not because I'm a proctologist, but just hanging around them, right? And there are two kinds of assholes. So one asshole is an egomaniac asshole, that it is the company, the product, the service. Everything is about me. I have my personal assistant. My personal assistant has a personal assistant. My driver has a driver. My PR firm has a PR firm. And, you know, and I have this entourage. And, you know, this is my posse when I go to Comdex and when I go to CES. That's the asshole egomaniac. There's another kind of asshole, and that is a mission-driven asshole. And I will tell you that Steve Jobs was a mission-driven asshole, and his mission was to make the best computer possible. So if you could help him do that, you were in like Flint, and if you stood in the way of that, he ran you over. Now, I'm not saying you have to be an asshole to be successful. Melanie Perkins proves that that's not true. But I'm telling you that if you have to be an asshole, you should be a mission-driven asshole, not an ego-driven asshole. So
I'm going to say that's one. Any advice that starts with "if you have to be an asshole" has never been uttered in four seasons of Breaking Business. People who listen to the show know I have a no asshole policy. I believe that nobody, no matter how mission-driven they are, has the right to go below the lines of respect with anyone else. As soon as you do that, you lose me. And maybe it's an era. Maybe it's you know, the times we live in. I don't think you can lead the way Steve Jobs led before and have quite the same results. Maybe I'm mistaken. Plenty of assholes out there, but I don't know that that's the way anymore.
Well, I will say that, you know, if you did a 2x2 matrix and you said asshole, not asshole, brilliant, not brilliant, the easy thing is to be the asshole. The hard thing is to be brilliant. So just focus on being brilliant and then do not be an asshole. It is not necessary, nor is it sufficient. And just because Steve Jobs was a mission-driven asshole, just become mission-driven. That's good enough.
That's a hell of a conclusion, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. Guy Kawasaki, our guest today, a true titan of marketing and innovation. Despite his waving it off, it was certainly not luck. This man has done some incredible things. He's written great books. And it's been an honor to have you on the show today, sir. Thank you so much for taking some time.
Thank you very much.
To talk to us and our audience.
I, you know, my next book coming, just PJ, so you know, is called Poor Dad, Poor Dad. So I hope you'll have me back on to discuss
PJ,
that.
PJ,
you know what? Next time,
on it.
If we go to Leha Bakery and we get the Loco Moco, you're buying. That's all I'm going
to say. First we get Loco Moco, then we'll get Malasadas.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. Don't let me pull out the hummus jokes as an Israeli.
There's no hummus in Hawaii.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, guys.
Maybe we should append it to Malasadas fixes everything.
Oh, that's so true. That is true.
You're going to have to explain to Tao what Malasadas are.
They're little bites of heaven. That's all that is.
Is that right?
Yeah, okay.
Tao. Don't know that I've ever had that, though.
Yeah. Tao, as the Hawaiians and Japanese say, Zai gesund.
Oh, so true.
Nice. Well done, sir. Touche.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard? Want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook, visit us on YouTube, and please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.